Hi,
Hello.
Debbie, how are you?
I'm very excited to be speaking with you. I can tell you that much.
Nice. Well, likewise.
You're a great way to start my morning. And
I can't tell you how much that makes me feel happy. I'm glad to be a part of your morning.
I'm such an admirer of your work, and to see now what you've done with a sequel, which is something we don't see from you, it just blew my mind. I watched this for the second time before I went to bed last night. So, no, it did not. It gave me a great sense of comfort knowing that there are people out there like Jake Rosser who do want to fight for what's right.
Oh, that's good. That's great. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. Was your second time watching it? Did you see more the second time? Well, explain
Absolutely.
that to me.
No,
Okay.
absolutely, John, because you have so much packed in here. You've got two levels happening here. You have Jake's psychological and self-analytical level, philosophical level going on. And then you have the action and all the hoops that he's got to jump through. It's just one tragedy after another, one battle after another. And I love how your action equates with Jake's mind and his psychological and philosophical status. So, as hard as he's trying to navigate his past and PTSD, it's like everything that he encounters is just another hurdle that equates the hurdles in his mind.
It's sort of and like sort of humanized form of his psychological trauma, or it's
Yes.
the personified obstacle that he's dealing with internally, that he now has to overcome externally. I'm glad that you enjoyed that. I mean, that was a really cool structure for us, working with Jacob King, the writer, to try to build that out, that this odyssey, through Los Angeles to get back to his wife, to protect his wife and his child, could actually operate on hopefully like a psychological, metaphorical level, much like the Odyssey does, right? I mean,
Yes.
it's like Odysseus is trying to get home to his wife. He's got a dog, Argo, so there's some similarities there. But it's also like these things that he's encountering, when he encounters sirens, it's about temptation, like, can you stay true to your wife? So similar in, the Scylla and Charybdis and the Whirlpool. It's like, what did these things represent to Odysseus? And similarly, we wanted the cartel to, and these obstacles and the bureaucracy and these police officers that aren't on the same page as him to similarly represent the things that he's trying to be as a protector and a provider and a functioning husband who's got his, animal under control, so to speak, literally and figuratively.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just love how you bring that forth and you make it relatable. It is you ha That's a connective tissue for you here with the audience. And I love the journey that you take us on. And by the time, I mean, we don't even get 10 minutes into the film, and it is explosive, to say the least, literally and figuratively. And you keep us going and going and going. You give us just a few moments here and there to catch our breath so that we are immersed in this with Jake and with Argos. And God, I love that dog.
He's cool. Yeah, he's super cool. He's such a cool dog. The Belgian Malinois, they're these unbelievable dogs, and they're working dogs. So the main dog who played, there were two of them that played Argos. They were brothers, Malawi and Uzo. Uzo was, they were like 4 years apart. So Uzo was the older brother, and he was a bomb sniffing dog in Afghanistan and is a working dog. So he and his brothers, they would run horses in the morning before coming to the set. So they would run these horses on these farms for like 4 hours, and then they'd come to the set and shoot with us all day. And Uzo was good for like the close-ups, and the one that you sort of, I think, feel that you love is Uzo. He's kind of like the slightly older, more handsome brother, and then his younger brother Malawi would do a lot of the physical actions of Argos, like running in the ocean or jumping over walls or jumping through cars and doing all that kind of stuff. You know, he was a slightly more athletic version of Argos. So it was incredible working with these things. I mean, they were very affectionate, but they're also, you know, dangerous.
Yep.
And it's sort of the whole contradiction of Jake Rosser, right? It's like, can he be a father to this innocent child while being a dangerous creature himself, you know, and a violent creature trained by the United States government, like turned into a combat veteran and served our country and then patrolled our streets. And it's like, how do these guys go back home and be family guys? And, mm-hmm. and how do they really, really find like a connection with their wife when it's sometimes easier for them to, you know, talk to their dogs in the car? It seems in the movie like he's very open with his dog and his relationship with Argus. Argus is a good listener, you know? And yet, like, he can't quite fully open up to his wife, and how challenging that is. You want to be, you know, honest and vulnerable, but you don't want to, you also have to be a protector. So it's this, like, contradiction there, and he's all, you know, wrestling with that and trying to get that all straightened out throughout the film. And really that becomes the B story. You know, it's sort of looking into the relationship between me and his wife and how that, you know, what they're trying to reconcile while yeah. he's trying to get home to her in the A story. You know, so that was a really cool balance that Jacob was able to structure in the script. And I think it works really well in terms of, you know, being about their relationship in the end. It's not like one of those typical, like, just big shootout scenes. We don't, we always steered away from that. Like, deliver the action, but also do it in a way that you've never seen before.
You definitely do that, John. But I just have to say, and this is another way that you have humanized this story and given it connective tissue for the audience. Who doesn't sit and talk to their dogs more than the other people in their house? Everybody right. has more quiet moments right. connecting with their dog or their cat, but dogs in particular. Very humanizing. We've got Jake fighting with an insurance company on the phone. Everybody can relate to that, I think. So you have great humanizing touchstones here. But then you show us the flip side of the coin for Jake's world. And that's this darker side, the battles that he has to fight. And I have to say, you've got everything through. We've got cartels, big pharma. We've got things stemming from whistleblower, reporters. There's mention of China in there, dirty cops. I mean, you give us the whole kit and caboodle. And
yeah, I mean,
that just... I mean,
the crazy world out there.
Yeah. And then you bring us Totec, the personification of evil, for my money, right. who yeah. truly suffers with a god complex. That is looming. And the sound design, this is an element of this film that really struck me. The sound design and the vocal qualities and cadence of what we hear coming from Totec in through cell phones, through earpieces. It is chilling, and it really ups the ante and is almost like the voices that Jake might be hearing in his head.
That's a really cool reading of it. I mean, we wanted to make him feel otherworldly. I mean,
yeah.
just how do you really personify evil? Because on the practical level, when you look at what's going on the border, you know, and some of these, like, drug influx points, the carnage is mostly buried by the media. But when you look into it and you research it, it's so chilling. Mm-hmm. It's like ISIS videos had nothing on what these cartels are doing.
That's right.
This stuff is so demonic and evil that it's hard to wrap your head around it. So in order to portray, you know, that for an audience, and in order to make this qualities of this character and sort of this cartel enforcer, but actually to lean into the metaphysical and the spiritual kind of aspects of his presence, that his omniscience, you know, I know some people have a hard time saying, like, well, how could he possibly know? And it's like, well, the devil always knows.
That's right.
You know, I mean, Mike Tyson, I remember watching an interview with him, and he said, you know, when you make your prayers, the devil's listening too. You know, and he was right about that. Like, the devil is as much in your head as you're, you know, connected to your spirituality. It's yin and yang. It's like, it's all in there. And like, when we're watching Beekman have this voice in his head, you know, and he's effectively the flip side of the coin to Jake. And
yes.
He's the guy who's willing to play by the devil's, you know, deal. He's Faust. I mean, it's midnight at the gas station, and he's, you know, the checks come due for his beautiful home and his, you know, doting wife, a stay-at-home wife who you know, is none the wiser, but probably knows there's something lurking in the walls somewhere, you know, to explain why she's had such a beautiful life as the wife of this cop, this LAPD cop. You know, and Jake's just not willing to die by the devil's terms, right? And that comes into focus with his sobriety, you know, like step one of the 12-step program is like give up your control to God, right? Like in Muzzle One, he was effectively like he was confronting the devil. I mean, in this one too, it's like, yes, this guy's a cartel, Mexican cartel enforcer who's upset that Jake screwed up one of his distributors in Skid Row. Like one of these, you know, drug gangs is dishing out drugs to 52 square blocks worth of drug purchasers in an open air
yep.
drug market in downtown Los Angeles. And like, if Jake took them out, that's not going to make him very happy. So like, there's a practical desire to you know, go after Jake. But at the same time, like you said, like this metaphysical, psychological terrain is so interesting to explore. Like when you're battling suicidal ideation and PTSD and alcoholism, substance abuse, and you're trying to get your violence under control and your trauma and your rage and literally, you know, metaphorically control your animal, like who are you doing battle with? Like you're doing battle with forces beyond our world, our spiritual world. You're doing battle with the forces of good and evil. And in order to portray that, we wanted to lean into making him feel almost more than a man.
Mm-hmm. And you succeed. And one of the excellent elements of this film that you really succeed with, I love your visual grammar. I love what you and Peter, what you started in Muzzle, you continue and expound upon here in Muzzle City of Wolves. So I'm curious about what you were looking for in the visual grammar to deliver a visual tonal bandwidth that would mirror and complement the emotional tone that is unfolding.
Well, Peter Vermeer and I have done 4 films together, mm-hmm. And so we have a long relationship where we've done Crypto, Bad Hombres, Muzzle, and this was our 4th film together. So we've had this long working experience together. We have a shorthand, and we thought that in Muzzle 1, we were going to go for this, something we'd never done before, which was shoot spherical and shoot with a taller aspect ratio and shoot 1.85 in order to sort of inject this kind of reportage realism into Muzzle 1. And also we thought by making the frame taller, we could include the dog and the human in the same shot. It mm-hmm. didn't end up working the way we planned. And we ended up sort of like jettisoning that plan. And we would just punch in and do sort of isolated coverage of the dog and Jake Rosser. And so this film, because that became kind of like irrelevant in terms of the style, you know, and working with animals and whatnot, we decided to go anamorphic. So we went anamorphic and did a completely different kind of visual language for Muzzle 2. We wanted to evolve it tonally and visually. I mean, the same way that, like, you know, I watched the Mission Impossible franchise evolve from a noir, from a spy noir Brian De Palma film to a anamorphic action film with John Woo. It's like, oh, you can do that with a franchise? Like, you can actually tonally bend it and visually bend it. You know, a film that had no slow motion, and then all of a sudden in the second one there was all this slow motion. It's like, oh, you can kind of evolve the language mm-hmm. that you're telling the story within the franchise itself. So that became interesting to us. those anamorphic frames now. Now we could get very close to Jake. It is a subjective film. The first one's subjective. The second one's subjective. So that does mean getting close to your subject. And, you know, in doing that, you're able to sort of, you know, and then you've got Aaron Eckhart. And it's like just sitting on his face in a close-up when he's confronted with, you know, having to effectively commit suicide in order to save his family. And this is the thing that he's been battling with since the war. Like, you know, and a lot of vets struggle with, you know, suicidal ideation. And we, in fact, we even partnered with Rally for Vets that helps get trained canines for suicidal vets and for other veterans that need, you know, help and company. And so this is really resonating with them. But visually, I wanted to get really close to him. And sometimes Peter and I even thought, Dan, did we get too close? But there's some moments where I think it's just so bloody effective when he's, you know, when he looks over at Cutler in the restaurant, he's got a gun to his head. It's like, man, you are really close to his face there. And Aaron Eckhart, like, you can see just like this searing pain on his face and anger and all of this stuff right beneath the surface. And it's just an incredible performance by him. So what better way to do that than to put like a beautiful anamorphic 2-3-5-1, you know, aspect ratio frame on Aaron Eckhart's face and watch him, you know, try to contemplate suicide. It's like, that was a cool approach. And then of course, like, you know, working on the color and working with great camera crew and gaffers and a great crew on this film helped us out achieve, you know, what we wanted to go for there.
And you've got a great fluidity with the camera, particularly in the action pieces. And I like that. So it's not disjointed. It's going with the flow versus a camera that is just up on sticks and sitting there.
Yeah, we had an incredible Steadicam operator, a guy named Dale Rodkin, who was very good. I think what we did was he was out of our budget, but we decided to splurge. Get Dale, bring Dale in off the set of, like, you know, the latest Mark Wahlberg movie or whatever he was doing. And he came in and he was a great partner for us in the camera department to, you know, help with these shots. For example, the Beachman in the hospital when he's panicked and calling his wife and realizing the screws are really being turned on him and he's trying to walk her through. That whole sequence is actually this kind of floating Steadicam. That's a very complicated camera move. It's a 100mm anamorphic lens. So that lens weighs, like, I don't even know how much it weighs.
A ton.
Tonnage. It's like a very heavy, very heavy long lens. And it's on a Steadicam. And the Steadicam itself is very heavy. So to now have a 100mm anamorphic lens and just be kind of floating with the actor that close, holding that close up, is incredibly complicated. I mean, the guy was like doused with sweat, you know, every take, like just gasped. I mean, not to mention the opening shot is a, you know, 3 or 4 minute, very complex Steadicam shot that Dale executed brilliantly. So, you know, he became a really, really powerful collaborator for Peter and I on this film, along with the rest of the camera team and the lighting and electric and grip team. We had a really great technical group on this, this movie. We're able to execute those things that you're noticing when you're watching the film.
Well, you definitely, it was worth the splurge to get him for Steadicam.
I think so. Yeah, no, I knew it when we were shooting it. I was like, this guy's worth every penny.
Now, another element here that is, I've got to ask you about, working again with Bella Erickson, your editor. How challenging was the edit on this one? Because we have flashbacks of what's happening, of what Jake's internalizing in his mind, which is definitely, that's shot much lighter and brighter for the most part. But you're going back and forth between this action into his mind. It's a dicey, you know, you're walking a tightrope here so that everything is cohesive and comes across. So how challenging was this edit? Did you let Bella just have free reign? What was this process like for you?
We've done several movies together as well. Yeah. She did Bad Hombres with me and we did The First Muzzle, obviously. So we have a great working relationship as well. I'm really lucky to have Bella, you know, as lucky to have Bella as I am to have Peter you know, on my team working with me. So she and I work together. Like, she does the assembly, and then once she's assembled the scenes and sort of has a fresh take on it, I give her almost no direction, other than, you know, she gets the script notes, and she's obviously read the script, and she's watching the dailies. So other than that, I'm not telling her, hey, I was thinking in this scene you should cut to this and cut to that, because the whole point is she might come up with something that I didn't even think of
sure.
when I was shooting the scene. And so she does that. I allow her complete free reign, and she comes up with some incredible stuff that I never thought of. And sometimes we don't touch a scene when she's done it, and then other times we'll dig in. And then what we do is we sit together for a few months, and we sit, you know, every day I show up at her editing suite in Laurel Canyon, and we go through scenes, and we just kind of, it's like being in a band and like rehearsing or something. She's a musician, so she's got it's her music studio that we edit in, and so like we'll go there and we just riff, we have lunch, we talk, and we really talk a lot about the psychology of Jake and the psychology of his wife Mia. And I love editing this film with getting a strong female perspective, and that's really important in this kind of story, because it's about a relationship, and it's about like, can he be a husband? Like, can he, you know, with all of these problems and these problems with addiction and violence and all these things. And it's like, Bella has a lot of experience that overlaps with my experience just in life, but she comes at it from the female perspective. And mm-hmm. so we have really fascinating conversations every day about what it's like to be in this situation. And she's always talking about it from the female perspective. I'm always talking about it from the male perspective. And she's, first and foremost, she is about performance, and same with me. And so it's sometimes in a scene, you know, they say, oh, you can't cut this shot together with that shot, or you can't cross the line and shot reverse shot if you're editing the sequence and whatnot. But for us, we'll break every single rule if the performance is great. So performance is number one. That comes from Nick Cassavetes, who introduced me to Bella after she edited and got a bullet for him. And Nick was an actor in Bad Hombres, and we had to replace our editor, so he introduced me to Bella. And Bella learned, you know, from Nick that, you know, and Nick, of course, learned from his father, John yep. Cassavetes, like, performance above all else. And so that really trickled down to me, you know, emulating that, like, performance above all else, above all else. So really crafting a great performance, and that's Bella's strong suit. She's so good at crafting, taking the best moments of a person's performance and cutting those together. That's where she really excels. And then in terms of structure, yeah, she's got really brilliant ideas. You know, one of the tricky parts was cutting together the flow of, you know, when you have these separate stories, when Argos is taken by animal control and Jake's taken by this cop and arrested and, you know, locked to a hospital bed in the hospital. And how do we follow both of those threads?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she came up with that really clever idea of Argos running through the corridor and kind of smash cutting to Jake running through the basement
yeah.
corridor, that to a certain extent, Argos is Jake and Jake is Argos, you know. They are the same kind of emotionally, you know, in a way. Like, they're both trapped, they're both escaping, they both represent the same thing. So that was very clever. And so she comes up with these clever things. And, you know, when Jake is remembering, when he's kind of running past those cops or in the car and he's zooming past the cops, that edit of like the cop car zooming by and then his wife stepping into frame, crossing frame, and him having that flashback with his wife, like, that was her idea there. And she's got great ideas just in terms of the flow of it and cross cutting. She's great at cross cutting. That I love to cross cut. I give her a few references every movie. In this movie, I gave her a film called Upstream Color by Shane Carruth, which was like, you know, very different movie, very, very different movie. But in terms of the way he cross cuts things and then using score to kind of make things seem dreamlike, that was the kind of inspiration for this movie. I always give her one movie to watch, one or two movies to watch prior to editing. And she just totally gets it. I don't have to say anything more.
Well, I'm so impressed with her editing. You know, like at the 30-minute mark, we have essentially a Russian roulette standoff in the Mexican restaurant. The tension is built so beautifully. We feel the emotion that's happening with Jake, with Cutler. Again, humor. We even get some humor in here at the 57 minute mark when Jake is trying to deal with OnStar in a car. And yeah. It lightens the moment that leads us into a huge setup. But she does such a wonderful job at building the tension, letting us see and feel the emotion. And as you said, it's in the one sense, during that one scene, in the cross-cutting, Jake is Argos, Argos is Jake. And I think for a lot of the film, that is very, very true from the very beginning, where Argos, he doesn't want to go into attack mode when he's given the command to do it. And he's holding back, just like Jake is holding back. So we really get that, a boy and his dog connection through this whole film. But everything, John, is just so well done. I love the look. I love the emotional feel, that emotional tonal bandwidth. It's just fantastic, and I want a third installment.
Well, that's so, so, so great to hear, especially the fact that you enjoyed the kind of irreverent humor throughout. That's one of the things that Bella and I really share, and Peter and I really share this, you know, and Jacob as well, the writer. Like, we all kind of have this, very, you know, this gallows humor throughout the whole film, as tense as it is. And that's, to me, if you can kind of execute that tone where it's irreverently kind of funny, but it doesn't undermine the tension, and it's tense without undermining the irreverent humor, then it's like this unbelievable North Star to try to go after. And I'm so happy that you dig it, and we have a third one that, you know, set up and ready to go as long as the studio wants it. So we'll see if people go out and watch the film in theaters now, and if they, you know, get it when it comes to available to purchase on December 5th, and when they watch it on AMC Plus on February 6th, you know, and 6 months after that on Hulu, all these things, then they'll call us and they'll ask for number three. And Aaron's excited about it. I'm excited about it. So I'd love the opportunity to be able to make it. It's a very, very quick. It's probably the most insane in terms of action, and just, I mean, it's a Jake is in jail.
Yep.
Now what is he going to do? And so, you know, it's this incredible, tense script that Jacob King wrote. And I hope we get the chance to do it. We'll see.
I sure hope so. I mean, after this one, it's so visceral, it's bloody, it's violent, but it's human. And I'll look at Aaron Eckhart in anything. So.
Yeah, me too.
John, wonderful job. So well done. I do. I am crossing fingers and toes that we get that third one. And thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today about Muzzle City of Wolves. This has been fabulous.
Debbie, it's a pleasure, pleasure, pleasure. So great to talk to you, and looking forward to talking to you again next time.
Same here.
Thanks, Debbie. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.